Listen now, on demand, or download abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, Paul Barclay with you. Thanks for joining me for Big Ideas here on RN Summer. We used to think of the human brain as an unchangeable organ. If it was damaged or diseased, or if parts of it weren't working properly, little could be done about it. We now know this is wrong. You can recover from a traumatic brain injury. It may even be possible to dramatically improve the lives of those with Parkinson's disease, MS, chronic pain, stroke, or autism. Today on Big Ideas, a man who's done more than just about anyone else to change our view of the brain. Mention the term neuroplasticity, or the plastic brain, and you may automatically think of Norman Doidge. His book, The Brain That Changes Itself, was a huge bestseller and immensely influential. He's followed it up with The Brain's Way of Healing, which delves even further into the possibilities of repairing the brain without drugs or surgery. The book details 80 or so case studies, some of which we'll talk about. Let's head to the powerhouse in Brisbane, where I'm in conversation with psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, researcher and writer Norman Doidge. Hi, Norman. You were a philosophy student and you were a poet before you became a doctor, which suggests from the very beginning as a clinician you were perhaps more open to challenging conventional notions of medicine than perhaps those who've taken the traditional pathway. Would that be a fair assumption?
There's not a contrary bone in my body, Paul, but philosophy is interested in opening questions and examining fundamental premises, and poetry is interested in, amongst other things, metaphor. And when it came to talking about the brain, neuroscientists and clinicians, starting roughly around the time of Descartes, began to describe it as a machine. And as a young philosophy student, I tried to understand what that meant and how something that was inanimate would be the metaphor for something that's clearly animate. But I hadn't studied medicine or biology at the time, and I didn't think that I deserved to be able to challenge it unless I had studied it. And I, of course, hoped that they were right in some ways. And as I got further and further into it, it became more and more apparent to me that it was a metaphor. And like many metaphors, if overused, that, you know, they become cliches that conceal more than they reveal. So yes, the background in poetry and philosophy, I think, did equip me to, when it became clear that this machine metaphor was actually causing problems, to be more confident in questioning it and labeling it as such. Mm.
So brain plasticity, for those who may be skeptical, was the subject of a Nobel Prize for Medicine back in 2000. How advanced, though, is the science of plasticity? Because this is a relatively new field. There is still much we don't know. Mm-hmm. Much of what we'll talk about tonight, I am assuming, has not been proven in, like, double-blind, randomised trials and so forth. So where are we at, roughly, with neuroplasticity today?
Well, it is, to some degree, in its infancy within mainstream medicine. But on the other hand, you know, musicians are making use of plasticity when they train. Martial artists are. Speech therapists have been, and certain physiotherapists have been using it. So there's a tremendous amount of knowledge. Practical applications of plasticity have been around really for, I do not exaggerate when I say millennia, because the idea of the brain as a machine was not something that was used, for instance, in the East. Mm. And it wasn't even used, really, in the West until the time of Descartes. So there's a lot of practical knowledge about it. As for double-blind studies and so on, look, most of the neuroscience upon which it is based do involve rigorous such studies. Mm-hmm. And I would say two-thirds of the treatments in my book have been subjected to these studies. I mean, there's 2,000 studies. You know, the book in large measure is about how energy is the fundamental
Yes.
language of the brain and or patterns of energy. And energy-based treatments like light and sound and vibration and movement can affect it. There's about 2,000 studies of lasers. There are 450 studies of a concept called learned non-use that I talk about. That's very important. So it really varies from chapter to chapter. In some, where the people are very much on cutting edge, by definition, granting agencies are just beginning to fund some of those studies. You can't be on the cutting edge and have millions of studies behind you
Yes.
all the time. It's an oxymoronic idea. But my approach is to look at all available evidence, and that includes clinical cases, hard science studies in labs, that's a lot of it, randomized control studies where they're available, common sense, and to try to put it all together and see what's meaningful.
Your own book editor, James Silberman, had a stroke and was told by a hospital neurologist that he would be unable to use his left arm and leg. So he was in the unique situation of being someone who'd edited your book, a book that, as we now know, would be very useful for his recovery. He followed some of the techniques in the book. Tell us how it's worked out for him.
Well, I just want to say that it was halfway through writing this book that Jim had a stroke. He had been put on a blood thinner, and he was on too much of it, and he had a stroke in the middle of a theater in New York. Luckily, he was rushed to the emergency room. There was a doctor right behind him. Somebody, you know, New York, nobody minds their own business. And Jim said something to the effect of, you know, something wrong with my arm. I can't move my arm. Suddenly, cell phones light up, and someone tells him, you know, you'd better get to the hospital. Anyway, he got there, and they were able to stop the bleeding, but not before he was paralyzed on one side. And I got one of these calls. I'd handed the chapter on light in December, and so it was Christmas time, and there was a break, and so I hadn't heard from him for 2 or 3 weeks. And then his wife, Selma, called me and said, Norman, I want you to know Jim is okay. It was one of those calls, and of course, we hadn't heard that there were any problems with him, and when you have a brain bleed, you worry about whether the person's going to survive. Anyway, we managed to sneak into the hospital a low-intensity laser that he stuck in his nose.
As you do.
To basically help resolve chronic inflammation and swelling, which can be very, very dangerous at that point. And then he had some movement, surreptitious movement done in the hospital while he was there. And he really marched through practically every chapter in this book while he was recovering. It was very, obviously, I mean, I was just deeply stricken when this was happening because this was such a test. And I had actually hoped that he would do a few more things, but he wanted to finish the book because he said, look, I think this is really important for people. And no sooner did I hand in the final manuscript that he went for the last piece of this, which was at the Taub Clinic, which I wrote about in the first book. And he took I flew down to Alabama after he'd done it about a week and a half, and I saw him take his first steps. So he's subsequently gone back, and he's got more movement of the hand, and he can walk. He's doing more work, but he's no longer confined to a wheelchair. He walks around his apartment, so he's made a pretty substantial recovery.
And the low-intensity lasers that you talk about, and this comes up throughout the book as a form of treatment, a technique for dealing with sort of brain stimulation to some extent. Can you explain to us how that works?
Sure. Well, let me step back and say what I think happens in many, many brain problems and much brain damage. When you're a student in the health professions, you're trying to learn all these different diseases and you try to learn to distinguish them. And Western diagnosis is very focused on differentiating things because the presumption is that different things will require different treatments. But a number of neurological conditions are very similar in some ways. You know, Parkinson's, MS, stroke, traumatic brain injuries, many of them will have balance problems, multitasking problems, depression. And not just depression that's a reaction to getting the illness, but thought to be related to the illness, coordination and movement problems, and so on. So what I did was I reviewed what I thought was happening that was making many mental or many neurological problems so similar. And I came up with the following, and it was based on electrical physiological studies of what's happening in the brain and some things that I'd learned while doing the brain that changes itself. And so the first thing is that we used to think that if a person had a stroke, and let's say in the right leg, and they lost 90% of their function, that 90% of the cells that process movement in the leg, mostly in the motor cortex, on the opposite side, must be dead, or the tracks coming from them must be interrupted. And what you find is the following, that some of the cells, but not all of the cells, are dead. Some of the cells that are accustomed to getting electrical signals from the dead cells are suddenly bereft of those signals. And so they're not functioning well. And then there are cells, a large number, that are functioning like sick cells, and they're firing irregular signals. You know, medical students are taught that neurons are either on or off, but that's not quite the way it is. The only time they're totally not firing is when they're dead. In a healthy state, they have a basal rate. It's usually, but not always, a slower rate. Mm-hmm. And then when they're firing a signal, it becomes a faster rate. So a sick cell will still be firing a rate, but it might not be the right rate. So the sick cells are kind of like a heart, if you will, that's having an arrhythmia. They're firing at the wrong rate. That's junk data. And they're giving that irregular, that junk data to healthy cells, which then are not functioning. Now, I call this configuration the noisy brain. Mm. And the noisy brain is working very, very hard and getting very little done. And when the brain doesn't get something done, the circuitry in the use it or lose it plastic brain, which is in some ways like a muscle, starts to atrophy and waste away. The person tries to use, let's say it's the leg, for a particular function, like, you know, moving it like that, and nothing happens, and the brain learns that that doesn't work. And that leads to further dormancy in the circuits. And so that turns them off. And what Edward Taub discovered is that they can be turned back on. They're just dormant. So back to light. Mm. One of the things that light can do is it can energize the powerhouses, the Brisbane powerhouses inside the cell, which are called the mitochondria. They can turn them on. They can also unblock chronic inflammation, which means they can be very, very helpful for any autoimmune disease or things like rheumatoid arthritis, things like that. But in the brain, they can help power up cells without causing harm. You know, a lot of us, depending on how old we are, have seen Goldfinger, and we hear about lasers, you know, about 1963 or 64, when they're used to cut Bond in half. Mm. Those are hot lasers. They destroy flesh. But low-intensity lasers take certain frequencies of light that promote growth and healing. And, of course, you know, the ancients knew this very well. Mm. That, you know, light was essential for growth and for healing, and they would lay people out for healing, and certain wounds heal better in light, and so on.
The Egyptians were sun worshippers, really, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And like many worshippers, they expected their god, Ra, to heal them.
And there was some research done some time ago that indicated that sun exposure may actually help very much some people with particular types of depression, I understand, as well.
Yes. You know, that's very well established now, seasonal affective disorder. I gather it exists only in Melbourne.
Certainly not in Brisbane.
Yeah.
On RN, online, or on the ABC radio app, anytime, you're with Big Ideas. I'm talking with Norman Doidge about neuroplasticity and the remarkable ability of the human brain to heal itself, to block out the sensation of pain, for example. Let's head back to the powerhouse in Brisbane.
Look, let's talk about one of the chapters I found particularly interesting was the chapter on pain. And as we know, chronic pain is now a major problem, a big medical challenge with doctors being pressured to prescribe strong painkillers that can be seriously addictive and over time actually not terribly useful. Tell us about the ability of the brain to shut out the sensation of pain.
Well, I learned about this I talked about it a bit in the first book. The main theory of pain was the gate theory of pain, which is a very sophisticated theory, and there are all sorts of, shall we say, switches from the body all the way up through the spinal cord into the brain that can turn pain off. And everybody knows about it in theory, but the question was, how do you put it into play in practice? We can obviously inject people with anesthetics and turn pain off, but you don't need these extraordinary measures. You know, when a person's in very, very great danger, sometimes, like soldiers in battle, they won't feel any pain until they get to the infirmary. And when Ronald Reagan was shot, he said, you know, I'd been shot many times in the movies, and I always acted as though it hurt. But when I was really shot, I learned that, in fact, it doesn't always hurt. And probably many of you have seen that clip of him being pushed into the car, and nobody realized he'd been shot. And that's part of the gate theory. Something switched it off. But Michael Moskowitz was a psychiatrist turned pain physician, and he had two very important personal lessons in pain, and then came up with the very important approach to chronic pain. So first of all, let me say the difference between chronic pain and acute pain. Acute pain, believe it or not, is our friend, and it usually tells us not to move a limb that's been injured because we might further injure it. And people who can't feel acute pain often die actually very young. They might have an infection in their leg and keep walking on it and get septic or something like that. Chronic pain is when there's an injury not only to a limb in the body, but into the pain system itself. So that's the central nervous system, including the brain. And it's a neuroplastic phenomenon, basically. Neuroplasticity is our friend when we want to, let's say, go to the opera and learn how to distinguish different voices in the chorus, and we can cultivate, you know, our brain circuitry so it's more and more differentiated over time with effort, and maybe even devote more circuitry to that. But when it affects the pain system, and let's say you have a nerve that's being pressed on over and over again, what happens is more and more of the brain gets devoted to processing that pain, so you feel it over a longer period of time and over more of the body. And it's plasticity gone wild. So what happened is, one lesson for Moskowitz was, he has a boyish Huck Finn quality to him, and he was with a friend just before a July 4th parade in San Rafael. He heard that they were storing some tanks for the parade, and he snuck onto one of the tanks, and then he went to jump off, and his corduroy pants were caught in a piece of metal sticking out from the tank. And he heard three pops, and that was his femur, the longest bone in the body, cracking. And then he lay there, and he had a 10 out of 10 pain. That's how pain physicians measure it. That's like being dropped in boiling oil. And he was hoping an ambulance would come. And as he lay there, he discovered that if he didn't move at all for an entire minute, there would be, his 10 would drop to a zero. And he had this sort of thought, you know, I'd always taught the gate theory of pain, that there are switches in the brain, but now I really get it. And he was very interested in that.
So it's about unlearning pain, the sensation of pain, is it?
Well, ultimately he developed a chronic pain syndrome from another mishap, water skiing, and he injured his neck. And
yes, this was the chronic pain that he suffered.
Yes, yeah. And then he got a chronic... So the first lesson was, you know that thing I've been teaching my students?
It's real.
It's actually true. And, you know, if only we could actually begin to control these switches. Then he developed a chronic pain syndrome from a water skiing type accident, and he'd hurt his neck. And initially, it was just a small area in his neck that was in pain. But as time passed, more and more of his shoulder, his upper back, and his head would be affected in these bouts. and the slightest twinge would last a long time. So it expanded in time and space, typical chronic pain syndrome. And he was often 8 out of 10 pain, disabled really in many respects, to the point that often he couldn't go to work. And he started reading a lot about plasticity at that point. And as a pain physician, he knew that there are about a dozen different areas in the brain that light up when you have acute pain. And they light up like pinpricks on a brain scan. And if that syndrome develops into a chronic pain syndrome, neurons that fire together, wire together, and the maps actually expand, so those little pinpricks become more like supernovas if you were to look at a brain scan. Mm-hmm. So that was the first thing he knew. The second thing, and this is, you know, where he was so original, many of those areas are actually dual processors. They don't just process pain. So you may have noticed that when you're in pain, sometimes you might be a little bit cranky. And that's because some of the areas process pain and emotional regulation. Or you can't pay attention well, and some areas process attention and pain, and so on. And there were two areas at the towards the back of the brain that process imagery and pain. You know, you would, one wouldn't imagine that this is the case, but that turns out to be the case. So he knew from the literature and from the first book I wrote that plasticity is very competitive. Your brain gives over cortical real estate or circuitry to process what it's doing most of the time. So every time he got an attack, he decided that he would visualize something with imagery to try to steal back. And the brain scans had basically shown that about 15%, 20% of the maps, when a person develops chronic pain, gets stolen for additional pain processing. Mm. So he was just relentless. Every time he got an attack, he would visualize something. It didn't matter what he visualized. Interestingly enough, and this is really a bit of a distraction, people think that it matters what he visualized, but he chose to visualize those brain scans. Mm. Not because he had to, but because this had never been done before, and he had to keep himself motivated to realize, you know, that if acute pain can grow chronic, he would imagine a chronic pain brain scan going towards acute and then down to zero.
And so, this visualization of pain becomes second nature to the point where the chronic pain simply disappears and he no longer feels the pain in his neck. Is that right?
Yeah. What happened with him was the first 2 weeks, you know, nothing. Mm. But by the end of several weeks, he noticed he had some moments of being free of pain. And after several months, there were significant periods. And after a year, no pain. And I want to point out that he'd been tried on all the major medications, nerve blocks, mainstream stuff, and complementary stuff. And none of it had helped him. And by the end of this, he was off all medication and off anything else.
It's a fantastic story. And even more fantastic is the fact that he now runs himself a pain clinic where he implements those very techniques.
Yeah.
What can we say about how effective that's been for his patients? Are we seeing some slow but steady change in the way we can now deal with chronic pain, less reliance, for example, on those strong painkillers that are not, as you've suggested, necessarily all that useful?
Well, and sometimes they can be harmful. You know, I'll say a word about that. You know, our body produces endogenous painkillers. And the drugs that we use to block pain imitate those endogenous morphines and so on. And they were originally marketed during a period of time when we didn't really appreciate the extent to which the brain was plastic. So the idea was, if a person is in pain, let's just blast them with morphine-like substances more than their body is producing. But because the brain is plastic, it responds to that. And it says, whoa, there is so much morphine-like material floating around. Mm. Let's make the receptors less sensitive to it. Mm. And so you have to give them more medication, and then the same thing happens. So people become tolerant, and they get to the point where they're getting a lot of medication and very little response. So Moskowitz's patients, there are a variety of outcomes from people I've described who were on medication, disabled for 5 years, who completely went off it, to people I met who were on high levels of medication, who've been able to, and had, you know, terrible side effects, who were able to go to much lower levels of medication less frequently, but still need it some of the time. I mean, some of these people are, you know, really damaged bodies. But it's interesting because one of them, who I saw just recently, I've seen her a number of times, Jan Sandin, I wrote about her. I mean, if you saw the x-ray of her back, it's just terrible. And her back is still terrible. But she basically eliminated the chronic pain syndrome. And she very rarely has acute pain now.
We're going to range through as many of the case studies as we can, but as you can imagine, talking about them is rather detailed and requires a considerable amount of sort of backstory. Meditation. I can see the benefits of meditation, and many clinicians can now see the benefits of meditation, and in fact, many clinicians will advise people with elevated blood pressure to meditate. But you write of a computer programmer who, despite surgery, who, despite special glasses and drugs, lost his sight. But after moving to Greece, where he was given some deep meditation, relaxation and awareness and these hand-eye exercises, his sight was restored. How is this possible?
Well, there are many steps. But David, the man is David Weber. So basically, he developed an autoimmune disease called uveitis, and in which his body was attacking him, his tissues, and ultimately attacked his eyes. And he started to lose his sight, and he needed multiple operations. He got glaucoma. Ultimately, he had optic nerve damage. And he was, you know, he sent to the Canadian Institute for the Blind, you know, to learn Braille and so on. I mean, he was completely blind at a certain point. He, in early youth, had been a meditator, interestingly. And at one point he got in touch with one of his meditation teachers who said that there were these ancient exercises. They originally came from the Hindu tradition, but in his case via Tibet. And he said, why don't you try these exercises? And, you know, the exercises seemed so bizarre and so childlike for a man who'd had five eye surgeries and had been tried on steroids and everything, and he had one of his eyes was completely shot. It was basically a dead eye, as his ophthalmologist said. And the exercises were things like, close your eyes and imagine deep, dark blue. Or move your eyes gently up, down, left, and right. Cover your eyes and palm your eyes. Now, I have to go back to try to explain how these things actually might be helpful, because people will be forgiven if they think this sounds like magical thinking. At one point in his treatment, in the course of his illness, rather, because he was so tense about going blind, he went for some Feldenkrais classes. Now, Moshe Feldenkrais was a nuclear physicist, a major nuclear physicist, as a matter of fact, who had an injury to his knees. And at one point, he was himself sent for surgery, or surgery was recommended, and he was told that the outcome would be 50-50. So he said, I'm not going to do it. And he decided to try to understand, use his scientific observational capacities to understand if he could learn to move differently. And out of that came the Feldenkrais method. I had been exposed to the Feldenkrais method in the 1990s and thought it was something for aching backs and sore necks, something that actors or athletes might do. It was very, very gentle. But Feldenkrais really was a genius, and he'd read a lot of neuroscience, and he was one of the very first people to appreciate that the brain is plastic. So he developed certain techniques, which I had learned about in the 90s, where he started to work with people with severe brain problems. And first of all, he believed in mind-brain-body unity. Second of all, he learned that in many problems, where you have a movement problem or pain problem, or let's say a muscle is tight. The approach is not necessarily to strengthen the opposite muscles or to stretch the muscles, but to do very, very slow movements that your brain can be observing. And one of his books was called Awareness Through Movement. And what he understood was movement and sensing are not radically separated in the brain, and so that awareness can really affect your ability to move. And he would use these techniques with kids with cerebral palsy, for instance, or people who had had strokes. And instead of just moving their limbs, he would get them to be aware of how their limbs were moving by doing very, very gentle things. And his most dramatic case, and I'll get to Weber in a second, but you have to understand what he was able to do, to my mind, was a young girl named Elizabeth. And Elizabeth was born missing a third of her cerebellum. The cerebellum sits at the back of the brain. It's responsible for coordinating thought and movement. And she had cerebellar hypoplasia. The cerebellum has 80% of all the neurons in the brain. So this area the size of a peach is very, very dense. Yeah. And to be born missing 80% of your cerebellum is to be severely, severely compromised. Mm. It's unbelievable. So she couldn't make any normal movements. She couldn't eye track properly. And her parents were told she would be institutionalized, you know, sort of like she at best she'd be autistic or retarded. And this was at major medical centers in the United States. Anyway, it turned out that Feldenkrais had come to an area near where they lived, and they decided to see him. And Feldenkrais began applying his various techniques. So one of the things he knew was that, for instance, let's say a person can't, Elizabeth couldn't sit up. Mm. Most people think that what happens is there's a developmental program in the brain that teaches you to creep, to crawl, to raise your head, to sit, and then to walk. Mm. But Feldenkrais discovered that this is not the case, that everybody learns to walk differently, for instance, that no one ever learns to walk by walking. Mm. You have to learn those earlier steps. So he did a really, really careful analysis of what she couldn't do. And what he discovered is she couldn't do some very basic thing that babies often do, which is arch their backs. Mm. And so he spent hours basically moving her back and forth to get her to do the arching of the back. And at a certain point, she was able to do that. And he marched her all the way through development. And this is what a Feldenkrais approach would do, for instance, with someone who had a stroke. They'd kind of, and what the brain does is it learns these differentiations. So even though she's missing 80% of her cerebellum, he would be teaching her the stage-appropriate differentiations, and he understood that the brain was plastic. And he would make the movements for her. It's such a slow way that her brain could record them, and hence came awareness through movement. Mm-hmm. And at one point, it was very, very powerful because the parents were overwhelmed by all that they had been told and all the mainstream treatments that she had undertaken and she'd failed at. Mm. And he said, no, she will dance at her wedding. And anyway, I've met with Elizabeth and I spoke with her. She had interventions over many years, first with Moshe Feldenkrais, and then he got ill. He passed the treatment on to Anat Baniel, who works a lot with children. And Elizabeth today is, she runs a small business. If you didn't know that she had a problem, mm-hmm. you saw her moving and talking, you wouldn't be able to detect it. She has 2 degrees. She's read most of Tolstoy and Shakespeare. This was a girl who was supposed to be retarded and institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And yes, she danced at her wedding. And
incredible, yeah.
So it's all about awareness and movement. Okay, so now back to David Weber. And remember, you mentioned something about meditation and its power to change the brain. Moshe Feldenkrais was also one of the first black belts in judo, and he got a lot of Eastern traditions that had a lot to do with about awareness through movement in judo, and he integrated that with his treatments, although his treatment is very, very gentle, more gentle than being thrown by Moshe Feldenkrais. Anyway, David Weber was in quite a lot of despair. He went to a local Feldenkrais class in Toronto, and it was just because he was so anxious, he thought it would settle him down. The classes actually can do that. And he did find it settled him down. And then he heard that Moshe Feldenkrais had given a lesson in Tel Aviv, Israel, many, many years before, called, I think it was called Covering the Eyes. And it was thought to be helpful for people who had various kinds of eye problems. Again, very nonspecific, the kind of thing that would be almost alarming to a Western ophthalmologist. Mm. But he started to do these exercises. And so he did them in combination with the meditation, and there were the Tibetan Hindu exercises he got, and he found that they worked. Now, here's let me get into the neuroscience of explaining how these simple things would work. I make a big point in the brain in the brain's way of healing of saying that there are four levels that have to be addressed when you want to heal an injured brain. First, you have to address cellular health if you can. So when David Weber had to do with his autoimmune disease, and that had not worked too well. Then you have to neurostimulate these dormant circuits. And then the noisy brain always has an imbalance of excitation and inhibition. So most of us, when we close our eyes, will see little bits of light. But David Weber was seeing all sorts of popping fireworks all the time. And that was the imbalance of excitation and inhibition. And you restore that with what I call neuromodulation. And then you have to relearn again, and that's differentiation. Now, when you look at me right now, and then you close your eyes and remember me or imagine me, roughly the same constellation of neurons are firing as when you look at me and as when you remember me or imagine me. And that turns out to be a very powerful tool. That's how these Eastern practices of visualization actually can work. That's why you can use imagination sometimes to fire up the same patterns. And so one of the things he had to do was he had to close his eyes and just imagine the deepest blue-black. So what he was doing there is he was recruiting the circuitry that's fired normally when the brain is very calm and the vision system is calm. So he was neuromodulating the hyper-excitable brain. The second thing is that when people are blind or have problems seeing, there's a lot of tonus and tension often in the eyes. Tonus means that the muscles are very contracted. And Feldenkrais was a genius at lowering tonus. And the Feldenkrais interventions and those slow movements back and forth that sound so simple were actually attempts to decrease tonus. Now, the reason that's important is this. We all know that when we walk into a room, our eyes sweep across the room, and those are called saccades. But Charles Darwin's father had discovered that our eyes move back and forth about 100 times a second or more, just to see. And if the tonus of the eyes is compromised, you can't get those microsaccades, and you need those microsaccades to see. So that if you were to freeze my eye muscles, or any animal's eye muscles, and you would actually not be able to see anything. And the reason is there's something called sensory decay. So all of you in the audience have forgotten that your bottoms are on the chair and you can't feel them until I point that out.
Yeah.
And you move around a little bit, and if you go to the bazaar and you try to get a material, you move your fingers across it. And that's to deal with sensory decay in the tactile sense. But the eyes also have sensory decay. So if you can't do microsaccades, you can't see nearly as well. So basically what he was able to do was lower the tonus by awareness of all. First of all, he got aware of the tonus problems when he moved his eyes gently back and forth, and that lowered it. And that enhanced his vision to the point that he can now see. I walked into a restaurant at one point, and from the end, I could barely see the other side of the restaurant, and he calls out, Norman!
Norman Doidge on the powers of neuroplasticity on Big Ideas on RN or online at abc.net.au. Let's continue the discussion.
I mean, one of the things that strikes me about the examples that you write about in the book is the conscientiousness of the patients involved and their ability to really work at a therapy or a technique and get the desired result. Much of conventional Western medicine is about seeking a quick fix for an ailment, an operation, some medication, you go to the doctor. You don't need to invest much of your own energy in a cure. Doctors, I think it's fair to say, are generally reactive and expected to be reactive in some ways rather than proactive. But when you're talking about techniques that do require a significant amount of patient effort, but on the other hand do seem to have remarkable results, are we talking about a need for medicine itself to change, to demand more of the patient, for there to be perhaps more shared decision-making between the clinician and the patient? And the payoff is that the patient gets results where he or her may otherwise not.
Yeah, I think it depends on the disorder, but I mean the general thrust of your question is, do patients have to be more proactive in these kinds of psychiatric and neurological conditions with a use-it-or-lose-it brain?
Yep.
Definitely.
And do they have to, as a follow-up to that, do they have to believe in the techniques that they are practicing?
No, they just have to be willing to suspend their disbelief enough to do it.
Because I imagine there would be some skepticism on the part of some patients.
Sure. I mean, most of us, past a certain age, have grown up in the doctrine of the unchanging brain, is, you know, based on this idea that the brain's like a machine with parts, and if a part breaks down, there's nothing a machine can do to repair itself. So, of course, there's going to be immature skepticism. Mature skepticism, I welcome. I actually think I came at this from mature skepticism. Immature skepticism arises when a person is believed in something that they didn't understand that well and they've been hurt. And it's a defensive reaction. And it's completely understandable. But after time, you know, a thinking person realizes that if they're just dismissive of things that they don't understand automatically as a reflex, they're going to make some big errors because, you know, in this complicated world, there's the things you know and the things you don't know and the things you don't know and so on. And the chances are that the things you don't know and understand are much greater than the things you understand. So immature skepticism in a healthy individual tends to break down.
Nonetheless, Norman, there must have been times when you could scarcely believe what you were seeing.
I wouldn't say I could scarcely believe it, but I would say I had to pinch myself.
What's the best example of that?
Oh, God, I don't know. Like, who do you love better, your mother or your father? You know, don't answer that. You know, each one in its own way. At different times, I'm just sort of smitten with different stories. I'm, you know, profoundly, profoundly moved at the power of music to help autistic children of some kinds, not all, but some, and help brain injuries. I mean, that just seems to me very almost magical. Of course, it isn't. And the burden of this book is to show none of these things are magical or miraculous, but to give explanations for it. But, oh, gosh, there's so many of them.
Look, let's talk about music, because you mentioned it before. I'm a music fan. I love listening to music. I'm aware that musical therapy is a burgeoning field. But the examples in your book go much further than this. We have Mozart violin sonatas and Gregorian chants that can demonstrably, it would seem, help with autism, dyslexia, ADHD, and how sound can help the connectivity between neurons, to put it simply. Tell us a bit about this and about the electronic ear and how it functions.
Okay, so let me take one step back and just say...
These are big questions.
Yeah, they are big questions, so... All the treatments I describe are non-invasive. That's, in some ways, the great charm of these. But how is this possible? Remember, I said there's a noisy brain in many of these conditions. And the reason that you can use energy to influence the brain through the body is because our sense receptors are all what engineers call transducers. A transducer is basically something that converts energy of one form into another, but more specifically, patterns of energy of one form into patterns of energy in another form. The electrical firing in my brain is producing movements in my lips and my diaphragm and so on, producing sound waves, which are then, so that's one transduction, which are then going into this microphone, which transduces them into electrical and sends them out to you, and you do various transductions out there. Once we learned that the brain was plastic, it became apparent to me that it didn't really matter how you got into the brain. Maybe you didn't have to crack skulls or bathe every brain cell with a medication for some conditions to change brain structure. So I want to emphasize, like if you have, you pop a blood vessel in your brain, you need neurosurgery. Neuroplasticity is not going to help you,
yes,
except maybe in the recovery period. You know, I'm not saying that there's no role ever for medication and that there's no role ever for surgery. That's just not what I'm saying. I'm saying we have a new arm, and in some cases these new interventions complement existing mainstream things and interventions. In some cases where mainstream interventions do not work, they will replace them. So if you're ever driving down the street and someone pulls up in a sports car with a blaring, you know, a song blaring a really hard, you know, heavy beat, and you want to roll up your windows because you can't think, what's literally happening in your brain is the neurons in the brain are now firing at the same rate as that beat out there. Because of transduction, you can influence the firing of your neurons. It gets way more sophisticated than that, but that's a simple concept. And it works with light as well. I mean, if someone was epileptic in the audience and we started flashing these lights, then they would start firing their neurons. So you see, this transduction is incredibly powerful. Now, I'll take one example, autism, because it's, you know, the most challenging. Autism, as I understand it, following Martha Herbert from Harvard, is not a brain disease simply. It's a whole body disease which also affects the brain. And autistic children have multiple signs of inflammation. Maybe not all, but many. This shows up on autopsy. It shows up in terms of antibodies floating around. And we now know that these inflammatory reactions affect the wiring up of their brains. We even know, for instance, that in many, many autistic children, there's not good linkages between the auditory processors for language and the reward center in the brain that gives us pleasure at language. Now, many autistic children, for instance, will cover their ears when they hear a noisy escalator or machine, as many people know, and they look extremely tormented and anxious, and may have a temper tantrum when they hear these sounds and so on. So what's going on, I believe, following Alfred Tomatis, who was an ENT doctor who made these first observations, is that they don't have functioning in their auditory processing circuitry and ear something he called an auditory zoom. So when you walk into a noisy party, first you hear booming, buzzing, confusion, and then what happens is you start to make out a conversation here and another one there. And that's your auditory zoom focusing in on the frequencies of human speech. And, of course, you need that zoom. Now, the frequencies of human speech tend to be higher if you look at all the frequencies human beings can hear. And the autistic children don't have a functioning auditory zoom. And what do they hear instead? They tend to hear exaggerated lower frequencies. Now, over the course of the development of our species, lower frequencies have tended to be threatening to us. They often represent the sounds of predators, which is why when you go and see a movie like Jaws, they go boom, 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 or if I was to talk like this, you would think I was taken over by an alien or something like that. And as the movie producers and sound people know, that would trigger your fight-flight reaction. Because, again, this association with predators. Well, poor autistic children are often stuck with that, which is why they're covering their ears. Now, once you go into fight or flight, you can't learn. You can't, they literally can't get tune into human language. And they're in survival mode. And you can't form attachments to people.
Which is, I just interrupted that point because it's an interesting fact that I found out from reading Norman's book that when a non-autistic child is stressed and then hears his or her mother's voice, oxytocin is secreted into the brain, calming and allowing that child to relax and to bond mm-hmm. with the parent. Autistic children, though, don't have that ability, which I suppose to which we can attribute, you know, why they get so anxious and stressed, perhaps because there's not that intuitive calming tool that's available to them.
Yes.
Very interesting.
So the electronic ear was developed by Tamanis, and he was a controversial figure simply because he was, in my opinion, ahead of his time, and he was making claims to help people in an age that didn't believe that the brain was plastic. Mm-hmm. And he learned that you can filter sounds in such a way. He learned many, many things that you could do with music, many. But one of the things he learned was you could train up an auditory zoom that never developed. So if a person's had some kind of brain damage, let's say there was lots of inflammation affecting the wiring up of their brain, for whatever reason that was caused, you would have to teach them to redifferentiate high and low. And it's always the same. You start in all these sort of brain training techniques where the child or the person is, and you do very, you know, small baby steps mm-hmm. of incremental training over time. And so he would train them with the auditory zoom, and I described the case of Timothy, who was a severely autistic kid, and he came to a place in Toronto called the Listening Center. And there, on the first day, he had the listening to, so he was having temper tantrums. His parents were told he would have to be institutionalized. About 18 months, he basically, to use his mother's language, fell away from them. Yeah. He stopped speaking normally and just would say, do, 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 do. No sort of emotional connection anymore. And by the time he got to this place called the Listening Center, he was, you know, tantruming all the time. He listens to the music, which included modified Mozart, for reasons I can explain, and his mother's voice, but put through various filters, so it's unrecognizable. And it's basically going into the frequencies of human speech and then other frequencies, up and down, gradually training the auditory zoom. At the end of, I think it was the second day, he's going home, and one of his family's members says, Timothy is different today.
Wow.
And then I think it was on the third day he hugged his father for the first time.
Yeah.
And Timothy today, he's gone from severely autistic to mildly autistic. He got an A in English. He's just graduated high school now. And, you know, he has some friends. And he's going to get a job. And he's not going to be institutionalized. And as his mom said, we really, when we started this, we only wanted one thing. I mean, we knew, you know, it was a very negative prognosis. Mm. They were told he'd never get better. We wanted our relationship back with him. And that's what they got, and much more. Mm. And then another boy I describe, and this is his real name because he's an adult now, Jordan Rosen. No one would ever guess he's autistic now. I'm not saying that happens all the time. Jordan is a really good outcome. Most outcomes are more like Timothy. But, you know, he's
almost been cured. Really?
I think Jordan has been cured. I mean, nobody in a million years would guess that, you know, he has any of the deficits involved in autism. I mean, he's witty. He's can listen to any frequency of music. He's very social. He's empathic, nuanced. His emotional regulation is fine. He has no stereotype behaviors or anything like that.
That was Norman Doidge, author of The Brain's Way of Healing, published by Scribe. Thanks to the Powerhouse in Brisbane. And that's the program. I'm Paul Barclay, back with you again tomorrow for more big ideas on RN Summer. Until then, bye for now.
Bright ideas for books this Christmas at the ABC Shop.
Share Australia's maritime history in Rob Mundell's Great Southland.
There's the new delicious cookbook, Feel Good Food.
And animal lovers will adore rescue dogs, full of heartwarming stories and pictures.
Plus, you could win every product in the catalogue. Valid at ABC Shops and ABC Shop Online only. See online for terms and conditions.
Light up your Christmas at the ABC Shop.
In-store at ABC Shop and ABC Centres, on mobile and online at abcshop.com.au.